TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
The Greek economist, scholar, and politician Yanis Varoufakis reflects on 1 year of genocide in Gaza. On October 2nd, the French author and film producer Frank Barat invited him to a conversation. Yanis Varoufakis comments on the role of global powers, especially the United States, in perpetuating the war on Gaza. Frank Barat asks him about the unparalleled violence, the media's portrayal of the situation, and the historical context of Zionism.
Hello, Yanis.
Hi, Frank. It's good to see you again.
I wanted to talk to you today because there's so much happening. It's actually hard to keep track. And maybe naively, many of us, including myself, thought we would never be talking about the Gaza genocide a year on, instead of talking about a ceasefire in Gaza. Israel has started bombing Gaza, Lebanon, Yemen, Syria. I've got to say, talking to my friends, I feel defeated in the last few days, deflated. I was wondering, and it's quite a broad question, but what's your analysis, if there is an analysis, of the situation right now?
Besides the depression at the sight of so many people dying, of so many other people being consumed by a genocidal mania, mostly good people. You know, most people are not neither very good nor very bad. This is what Hannah Arendt taught us. And yet you see people who are not necessarily evil being totally hijacked by the genocidal mindset. You know, there is such a thing as we speak now, genocide tourism. Did you see that cruise ship that left Tel Aviv with holidaymakers, with spectators, the purpose of whom was to sail by Gaza to see up close and personally the destruction, to cheer the bombs falling on the people of Gaza? But before we allow ourselves to be consumed by pessimism and sadness, it's important not to lose sight of what's going on. And, you know, we must always seek the truth about what's going on from the horse's mouth. So, you know that Netanyahu went to Washington recently, effectively to outline his war escalation policy and to get the okay from the Biden administration, which clearly he did. But before he got into the airplane to fly from Tel Aviv to the United States, the Knesset passed the resolution, a declaration. It said, and I'll just quote one paragraph, it said, the Knesset of Israel, this is verbatim, the Knesset of Israel firmly opposes the establishment of a Palestinian state west of Jordan, that is from the river to the sea, no Palestinian state. The establishment of a Palestinian state in the heart of the land of Israel will pose an existential danger to the state of Israel and its citizens, perpetuate the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, yeah, of course, and destabilize the region. Now, recently, only a month ago, the International Court of Justice decreed that Israel's occupation of the Palestinian lands west of the Jordan River was plainly, this is the language of the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, it is plainly illegal. The United Nations General Assembly voted overwhelmingly to back the International Court of Justice and call for Israel to withdraw from Palestinian territories, including East Jerusalem. So let's not forget that this is what it's all about. Here we have Israel determined, and this is not just Netanyahu. Let's not focus on Netanyahu, because when you've got a vote in the Knesset in favor of this essential declaration that from the river to the sea, there will be no Palestinians, and this is how there will be no Palestinian conflict. Of course, if you get rid of the Palestinians, there will be no conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. That is what the whole thing is. And, you know, Let me just want to say one more thing before shutting up. To understand the whole thing, we need to combine this recent decision by the Knesset with something that David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, said. At the graveside of Israelis, who in the 1950s, I don't remember which year exactly it was, very close to the border, to the fence with Gaza, were gunned down by Palestinians who had crossed the fence and walked into a village and killed some Israelis. Ben-Gurion went to that funeral and he gave a eulogy for the fallen Israelis, which is fascinating because he begins like you and I would have begun by saying, don't be angry with the Palestinians who crossed the border and killed our own. We would have done the same thing if we were them. We threw them off their land and we put them in there. We denied them hope. We denied them any possibility in the future of returning to their homes. So this is something we have to accept. So far, so good, right? And then in this infamous speech by Ben-Gurion, he continues to say, we have to keep expanding and we have to be armed and we have to kill them before they kill us, because they have a righteous anger against us. And if we are going to keep Israel a majority Jewish state only for the Jews and with the right to return for people who have never been in the area for 1,000 years, whereas these people whom we got rid of and put them behind the Gaza fence have no right to even come and visit their homes, now of course they're going to kill us, so we have to kill them first. Now, put together Ben-Gurion's ancient now, 1950 speech at the graveside of people who were killed by Gazan Palestinians, and the recent Knesset decision that from the river to the sea there will be no Palestinian state. Essentially, if there are Palestinians who stay, they will be as slaves, wage slaves, with no rights in an apartheid state. Well, you have the answer to everything that's happening. Everything else is simply stupid details.
Thanks for that. Context is crucial, but it's what's lacking immensely from the mainstream media and from sort of our so-called leaders. You were involved like in the highest sphere of power, during your tenure as finance minister of Greece. And I remember reading your book, Adults in the Room, and being fascinated by the lack of democracy of the European Union and other instances. When you hear Biden saying, and his State Department saying day after day, we do not want things to escalate in the region, the next day Israel does the beeper, the beeper thing where like it kills Hezbollah members, then Biden says do not escalate, the day after it's the walkie-talkies, then Biden says do not escalate, and then they bomb and kill Nasrallah in the most horrifying manner, killing hundreds of civilians. So what does it mean in practice when a power would say do not escalate, but actually do not take any action to avoid escalation, and quite the opposite, sends more and more weapons? And how are we supposed, us, the people, to react to that?
Well, look, my grandmother taught me from a very young age that you must judge people not by what they say, but by what they do. So if you keep arming the aggressor without any conditions attached, zero conditions attached, and then you simply give a pep talk, what is the pep talk all about? It's not because Biden ever imagined that Bibi Netanyahu would follow the advice of President Biden. Biden is not a stupid man. He may be very old and quasi-senile, but he's smart enough to know that there's no way on earth. I mean, Netanyahu never hid that, his intention was always to annihilate any chance of a Palestinian state anywhere near Israel, or anywhere in the world for that matter. He would love the Palestinians to be absorbed by other Arab countries and simply become Jordanian, Saudi, whatever. Huh? Because the very existence of the notion of a Palestinian nation is a threat to the supremacy of a Jewish state that doesn't have to answer about Palestinians to anyone, because they have been either eliminated or turned to Jordanians, Moroccans, or Egyptians. So Netanyahu has always been clear. But so has Biden in the final analysis. Biden, all his career, for decades now, he declares to be a Zionist. And he's got every right to do that. But we have every obligation to understand what that means. It doesn't mean being pro-Jewish. It doesn't mean caring about Jewish life. It doesn't mean sympathizing with a nation, the Jews, who have been persecuted in Europe for centuries. I am all that. Being a Zionist means to embrace the white settlers' dictum, a land without a people for a people without a land. That's what Zionism is. That we're going to come as Jews, as Zionists, to the land of Palestine, which is a land without a people. Now, they're not the first people to do this. The British, when they went to Australia, upon arriving, they found 5 million Aborigines there, right? But immediately, for legal purposes, they declared it terra nullius, a land without a people. That's the beginning of genocide. And then they proceeded to eliminate them, to the Aborigines. And since they were not people, it wasn't murder. It wasn't genocide. It was like eliminating kangaroos, right? So the moment you shift to a Zionist mindset that the land of Palestine, west of the Jordan River, is a land without a people, well, the next step is to ensure that it's a land without the people by eliminating them. So when Biden says he's a Zionist, essentially he says that he adopts the agenda of Netanyahu and of the Israeli state, of apartheid, at best, apartheid, and at worst, elimination, genocide. The tragedy of the United States is that it's not a democracy, that it's an oligarchy with one-party system that has two variants who oscillate in power, like Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Whether Trump is elected or Harris is elected, it makes no difference whatsoever, because this deep state, this one-party state, is totally invested in the Zionist project, because it is consistent with a number of interests that the economic forces hiding behind the one-party state in Washington, D.C., have. One interest, of course, is to use Israel as a huge American base in the Middle East to keep everybody in awe, to keep the Arabs divided, to keep their governments at odds with their own people, to ensure initially it was oil, now it is trade routes. That's one reason. Secondly, because the United States macroeconomy, I'm speaking here as an economist, is absolutely dependent on its defense budget. The American defense budget is its investment program. It is its macroeconomic stimulus program. When in 1991 the Soviet Union collapsed, because there are conflicts within Congress, the pharmaceutical companies do not want all the money to go to the Lockheeds, yeah, to the armaments industry. They would like some money for themselves. So it was difficult to justify, after the end of the Soviet Union, maintaining the military budget where it was at the height of the Cold War. So it came down. Immediately, there was a massive economic crisis in 1991 for anyone who is old enough to remember. And what happened? Well, America invaded Iraq. Saddam Hussein was their man. He was their bastard, to use an expression by Roosevelt, who used to call a Latin American dictator a bastard, but he said, but he's our bastard. Well, you know, Saddam Hussein was their bastard. They essentially told him to unleash a very lethal war against Iran when Iran was moved out of the sphere of influence of the United States with Ayatollah Khomeini. 2 million people died in that war at the behest of the United States. And Saddam Hussein was their agent. And they indebted him to Kuwait, because Kuwait was paying for the war. And then Kuwait, after the end of that war, demanded his money back. And the United States, when they needed the war, in order to replenish their armaments, in order to boost their macroeconomic stimulus, right, after the end of the Cold War, essentially they whispered into Saddam Hussein's ear through the American ambassador in Kuwait, if you take Kuwait, we won't mind. This was a way of inciting him to come in so that they would then attack him. And, you know, even after Hussein's army had lost the war to the invading Americans, it is well known now that the American Air Force had orders to empty all their cruise missiles, all their missiles, into the desert just to get rid of it so that they would buy new inventory. So that's another reason why Israel and the constant wars in the Middle East are essential to the United States. Now they have Ukraine as well. But, you know, so these wars are essential for the macroeconomic situation, equilibrium. There are many reasons why the United States is completely wedded with Zionism. So, in the end, Robert Fisk, whom I'm sure you remember, the wonderful British journalist who spent most of his life in Lebanon and in the surrounding areas unveiling the West's lethal role in the Middle East. He once commented that Palestinian liberation is important because not only will the Palestinians be freed if their struggle succeeds, but it's the only way that the Americans can become free. Palestinian liberty is, he said, a prerequisite for the freeing up of the Americans from a regime which uses the Middle East partly in the way they use the Ukraine, the new Cold War against China, in order to keep their own people under wraps.
Yeah, so what you're saying is that both the US and I guess Israel need the state of permanent war. So yesterday, Iran responded to months and months of provocation by Israel. We are facing, if you watch the mainstream media, an inversion of reality. Saying that it's Iran provoking Israel, where you have to remember that when we talk about provocation, it's not minor. They killed Ismail Haniyeh in Iran. They killed a very high-ranking Iranian official while killing Nasrallah as well. They've been provoking Iran for years. We know Netanyahu wants to go to war with Iran. But how do we fight this inversion of reality? You know, I can't bear watching the mainstream media anymore. You know, you've got Israel bombing everyone around, running amok, going crazy. And then you've got the Macron, the mainstream media telling you Israel is the victim and everyone wants Israel annihilation. 2 days ago, the Jordanian prime minister said in front of the whole media, here I am representing 57 Arab states. We tell Israel, we want peace. Get out of the occupied territories. You will have peace. We've been saying this for years. The Arab peace plan has been proposed to Israel year after year after year. So how do we respond to this? Really, this is like George Orwell, you know, this inversion of reality.
Frank, the answer, my answer, there may be better answers, but my answer is that we must always use Israeli and Jewish sources. Always. I did this earlier by mentioning the Ben-Gurion speech. So just quote him. Don't quote me, because nobody wants in Israel to listen to me or to you. But Ben-Gurion, just plaster it in there in front of the head. This is what your inaugural prime minister said. Then you can, if you want more radical voices, think of Albert Einstein's letter. Which he published in a newspaper in the United States, in which he says that he's seriously worried about fascist Israeli politicians who will create exactly what they are creating now. So let the proponents of genocide and the apologists of genocide and the enablers of genocide counter Ben-Gurion and Albert Einstein. This is what I believe the answer to your question is. But as far as, you know, what the Jordanian prime minister says, allow me to be less than impressed. Because Jordan has continuously, consistently played the game of Washington in the area. It has paid lip service to the rights of Palestinians. There's no doubt that they're annoyed with Israel, but they are not prepared to lift their little finger to do anything that seriously opposes apartheid and genocide in the area west of the Jordan River. These regimes have been co-opted by the United States. Think of Egypt. You know, the brutality of the Egyptian regime as we speak, there are hundreds of thousands of political prisoners under this dictator Sisi, the Generalissimo, you know, the Franco of Egypt, as I call him. And, you know, this is a major, major demerit, disadvantage of the Palestinian people, because supporters of Israel delight in pointing out the corruption of the Arab regimes and how the Arab regimes don't care about the Palestinians. I would take exception to this narrative that is 50-something Arab states versus Israel. Not exactly. The United Arab Emirates and Morocco and Egypt and so on, you know, were ready to, I mean, some of them, not some of them, under the Abraham Accords, they made peace with Israel while Israel is ethnically cleansing the Palestinians. Sadat began that in the 1970s when he made peace with Israel without any conditions about the Palestinians. So the Palestinians are being constantly betrayed by their own cousins in the Arab world. They know that. They understand that. And this is why Iran has become prominent. Because being a non-Arab Islamic state, which, by the way, you know, I think that there is a schizoid situation now, and one that makes it very hard for me to comment on what is going on in Iran and in the broader Middle Eastern area. Let me be specific what I mean by this. Now, I feel immense solidarity for the women of Iran who live under gender apartheid. My comrades in Iran are against the regime. I am in support of my comrades who are against the regime. At the very same time, this regime is the only one that supports the Palestinians against the genocide, in the context of the genocide. And they've been very, very measured. You're right. They have taken their time to retaliate when Israel has monstrously bombed and killed their leaders, the leaders of Hezbollah and so on. They announced when they would attack Israel so that Israel, Britain, France, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and the United States, of course, would shoot down their missiles because they wanted to make it was a demonstration effect that we cannot not act, but at the same time, we don't want to escalate. So you've got this extremely measured behavior by the Iranian regime outside the country, and gender apartheid and authoritarianism and Islamist fundamentalism within the country. So that is another impediment. You know, it used to be the case that us left-wingers, we luxuriated in the idea, by, let's say, in, you know, 1936, 1937, that, it, you know, they were the good guys and the bad guys. We, the socialists and the Soviet Union, the Union of the Socialist Soviet Republics versus the Nazis, versus the fascists and so on. Well, that is all gone now. Now there is a variety of regimes and forces that betray the Palestinians. And the Palestinians are on the receiving end of American imperialism, Israeli racism, Arab regime authoritarianism and betrayal of the Palestinians. And you end up with Iran being the only consistent supporter of the Palestinians, while at the same time behaving in a way which I cannot possibly accept in the interior of Iran. The hope that we need to exude, because we are running a very serious risk during this conversation, or I'm running a risk during my monologues, of depressing everybody. I think in the end, it is what's happening in Israel that will determine whether the Palestinians have a chance. It is true that the peace movement and the progressives in Israel are decimated. They themselves fear for their lives. I'm in constant contact with people in Israel, Israeli Jews, who fear for their lives because they advocate an end to the genocide. They can't even say the word genocide without being threatened, losing jobs, being beaten up, being arrested, and so on. But, you know, Frank, I am an eternal romantic. I believe that the young men and women who are part of the genocide and who are now, you know, in the heat of the battle, driven by adrenaline, when they go back to Israel at some point, even on leave, they will have sleepless nights. The memory of the bodies of the babies that they have killed or who were killed in front of them is going to haunt them in the same way that the Vietnam War soldiers, when they came back from Vietnam in the United States, they lived and relived and relived what they had done. They changed their mind. People like Oliver Stone, who fought in Vietnam and then came back and became an anti-war activist. This is, I think, the greatest source of hope. The resilience of the Palestinian people, international solidarity, and changes within Israeli society. Because let's face it, Israel is being destroyed by the people who are ruling it. At the moment, you know, what was good about Israel? This is a rhetorical question. There were progressive intellectuals, writers, authors, poets, musicians, a broadly humanistic Jewish, European, but also African tradition. And they, you know, the rich Jewish culture, that was one thing. Then there are the settlers in the West Bank, who are now overrepresented in the government, with people like Smotrich, those genocidal maniacs. Now they are taking over the government. And they are a clear and present danger for humanist, progressive, cultured Israelis in Tel Aviv, in Haifa. So the clash between those, the human proclivity for having nightmares when you have participated in a genocide, and we've seen this in Germany, we've seen this in the United States, we've seen it in Rwanda, we've seen it in former Yugoslavia. That's what I am putting all my hopes on.
You heard excerpts from a 35-minute interview of the Greek university lecturer, economist, and politician Yannis Varoufakis. Since 2018, he has been Secretary General of the Democracy in Europe movement. That's a left-wing pan-European party that he co-founded in 2016. Previously, he was Greece's Minister of Finance during much of 2015. Varoufakis' most recent book is Techno-Feudalism: What Killed Capitalism? You can find the full 35-minute interview under the title Yannis Varoufakis Reflects on 1 Year of Genocide in Gaza. It's on the YouTube channel of Frank Barra. He's a French activist, author, and film producer. And Barra is spelled B-A-R-A-T. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening.